Blog Talk Radio.
President Richard Trumka called these cuts wrong and indefensible.
as president's budget is more than just numbers. A president's budget is more than just numbers. It is a profoundly moral document. We believe cutting Social Security benefits and shifting costs to Medicare beneficiaries while exempting corporate America from shared sacrifice is wrong and indefensible. The budget cuts Social Security cost of living adjustments by adopting a so-called chained CPI formula that amounts to $130 billion of cuts to Social Security recipients. Edward F. Coyle, Executive Director of the Alliance for Retired Americans, said using this chained CPI is nothing other than unfairly balancing the budgets on the backs of America's seniors who've done nothing but work their entire lives toward earning the promise of Social Security's guaranteed benefits, which they've paid for. In addition, the budget shifts $64 billion of health care costs to Medicare beneficiaries, says AFSCME President Lee Saunders. The collapse of the private pension system means that Social Security and Medicare are more important than ever and should be regarded as solutions, not budget problems. Unfortunately, these proposed cuts would make things worse. NEA President Dennis Van Rokel says that cuts to Social Security and Medicare are the wrong approach. Right now, the focus should be on protecting and increasing benefits for our seniors, not pulling the rug out from them, as seniors and families are working so hard to make ends meet. Trumka also says that while the budget calls for major sacrifices by seniors and federal workers, its revenue-neutral approach to corporate taxes means it fails to ask big, profitable corporations to pay their fair share of taxes. Trumka and others also faulted the budget for failing to invest in enough jobs. Putting aside the injustice of demanding sacrifice from the innocent while letting the guilty off scot-free, the Obama budget falls short of putting our economy on a path toward higher wages and full employment. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says, to truly address the deficit and continue our economic recovery, we must focus on creating more jobs. That should be priority number one. But the president's budget falls short in that regard, says Trumka. Excuse me. Pardon me. By cutting the part of the budget that pays for the investments in workers' trainings and jobs, which has already been cut to its lowest level since the Eisenhower administration by another $100 billion. The austerity budget is bad economic policy at a moment when the economy remains weak and we urgently need more job-creating investments. However, Trumka and others did note the budget includes several praiseworthy proposals. AFT President Randy Weingarten praised the universal access to pre-kindergarten in the budget and its proposal to expand high school opportunities to more hands-on and more focused on thinking rather than testing, like those at PTEC, Pathways in Technology Early College High School in Brooklyn, New York. The president's budget also invests in our public schools and students through proposals to rehire teachers and keep them in the classroom and to preserve Pell Grants to make college more affordable and accessible.
Other positive aspects of the budget includes the strengthening of programs to protect workers against wage theft, unsafe workplaces, and employer retaliation. It also closes the outrageous loophole that allows Wall Street financial managers to pay a special lower tax rate. And it reforms some of the tax loopholes that allow corporations to get away with shifting profits overseas to avoid U.S. taxes. Trumka also pointed out that last November, working families voted for jobs and growth, not for budget austerity and benefit cuts. We urge the president to drop these cuts and build support for investing in jobs.
I don't know how that budget can pass. Republicans hate it, and so do the Democrats.
I don't know.
It's just Obama is a goof,
man. He's just a goof. I'm sorry.
He took a 5% cut in wages.
Yeah, he's a goof, you know.
That's supposed to help all the rest of us?
Take a 5% cut, yeah. Well, it's going to be a whole damn salary.
And even that's not enough.
You're not working, though.
Yeah. Not doing your job.
Horrible. I tell you, it's just
What is the AFL-CIO?
No, I was thinking of, I wanted to see this political action. Hold on, folks. The guy goes on to say that President Frederick, says, cutting a day of mail delivery would not save the Postal Service money, but would instead drive more businesses away. I read this part, but I wanted to reiterate.
The root cause of the agency's physical problem, you said, is the unique congressional requirement, the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act. That's the root cause of the problem, the pre-funded retirement benefits, which you said.
Yeah, yes.
So I don't know what's going to happen with that,
well,
if that can be repealed.
Without this requirement, spend billions each year to pre-fund the health benefit of future retirees, something no other government agency or private enterprise must do. The USPS would actually have shown a $100 million profit in the first quarter of fiscal year 2013.
And how many companies show that?
Not, well, you know, $100 million is not, I mean, that's good, but I mean, for the size.
For
it's a profit. It's a profit.
Yeah, it's a profit.
You know? It's for the size of that, it's a profit. But last month, in hundreds of rallies in large cities and small towns, postal employees, other union members and community supporters and others rallied to preserve Saturday mail delivery. Read more here, of course, on this. And so the related developments, the postal workers have announced, denounced rather, plans by the USPS to accelerate the closure of 71 postal
processing plants
that were due to remain in operation through 2014. And they said,
I'm not quite sure what a postal processing plant is, but it must be
like
a central office,
yeah,
a central place where they send out mail from.
Yeah, there's a big
one. I think Hartford must be one.
New Britain is one that they're closing. I heard that they're closing the new one, with the big one in New Britain. I know a couple of guys.
This is in Connecticut. That's what we're talking
in Connecticut,
about.
Connecticut, New Britain, Connecticut. Major delivery area. And, as is, the Postal Service is on the brink of cutting services in a way that will permanently damage our treasured institution. This would be a tragic mistake, and it is unnecessary. Congress must act now to enact meaningful postal reform that restores the Postal Service to financial stability without destroying service or harming postal workers. Got it. So, good luck, guys. I hope it works for you.
Oh, I sure do.
We're supporting it. We'll keep it doing so. Hang on 1 second here. I guess it's seriously slow. Here we go. Okay. Sorry, folks.
It just takes a minute to bring up some more news here.
Our guest hasn't called yet.
Well, it's not into it.
I understand that, Lila, but, you know,
we have about 5 minutes.
We have a few more minutes. I just want to need computers. I hate computers. I really do. There's nothing good. Everybody. You know what I'm going to do? I'd like to go to a...
Why don't you go to a quick break,
our guest will
call during that time.
And if not,
we'll come back with some more news.
Yeah. So let's go, and we'll be back in a few minutes. And Lila's favorite song. Now, I wanted to, I'd like to, while we're back, I have this letter by Trumka, President Trumka. All right, and it says, it talks about, it's really interesting because it's a timely letter that was sent to me today, and it's about, it's a petition, but it says, as Dwight Shemansko, a coal miner in the Cannon Elk mine near Smithers, West Virginia, put it, "It's ruined me, plain and simple. You might think he's talking about the long hours of the life-threatening workplace diseases he is exposed to in the mines, but he's actually talking about the assault on the National Labor Relations Board by extreme anti-worker members of Congress and their corporate donors. In the case of Cannon's miners, the attack on the National Labor Review Board means that workers are not getting payback or reinstatement, even though the NLRB were discriminated against for being union members.
Workers face retaliation all the time for simply supporting a union, and the NLRB provides one of the few means for workers to hold corporations legally accountable. It's no wonder right-wing extremists in the House are trying to shut down the agency." I think we have our caller on the line now.
Yeah. It turns out Trump was his family was miners.
Ah, okay.
Our guest is on the
line. Hello?
Hello. Yeah. Welcome to the show. Is this Napoleon Gomez?
Yes, yes, I am. He's speaking. Thank you.
Yes, hi. I'm very, very pleased that you were able to come on tonight. We part of your book, but you've done a lot. Most of the world probably isn't aware of, and also probably many, many union people aren't appreciative enough of how involved you are, and I was wondering if you could explain to us your title now and what you are exclusively involved with regarding the Global Union and the Mexican Miners Union, and where you and why you're in exile at this point.
Yes, yes, sure. Thank you. Thank you very much, first of all, for the opportunity to address your listeners and to everybody that is listening to this program. I'm Napoleon Gomez. I'm the president of the National Mine, Metal, and Steel Workers Union of Mexico. I am also a member of the executive committee at the world level on the biggest global confederation of unions, Industry All Global Union. And I have been also a member of the executive committee of the International Metal Workers Association and of the International Organization of Workers on Chemistry, Mining and Electrical and Energy Workers Union. And so I have international responsibilities, and I'm the president of the Mexican Mine and Steel Workers Union. I've been in Canada. I've been living for 7 years now because of political persecution which happened in Mexico against myself, against some of my colleagues and the executive committee of the union, and against the union itself. In 2006, the government of Vicente Fox, at that time when there was a mine, it was an explosion and a tragedy in a coal mine in the north of Mexico, Pasta de Conchos, and 65 miners died. And when we have been complaining about the terrible safety and health conditions that prevail in the mine, and the company Grupo Mexico from Germán Larrea, the chairman of the company, never made any changes in these terrible safety conditions that were prevailing. Even we had 3 strikes before how the tragedy happened. And then after 5 days of when the mine exploded on the 19th of February 2006, And after 5 days of trying to rescue our colleagues, our brothers, the Grupo Mexico decided to shut down the mine with the support and the back of the government, and they abandoned our colleagues, 65 of them, without knowing if they were dead or alive. So I accused the company of industrial homicide, or what you may call in the United States or Canada, corporate murder. And then they immediately launched a smear campaign against myself, my colleagues, the union, with a lot of defamatory news, which were false. And we were receiving threats, all kind of threats, including death threats. And I had to leave against my will. I had to leave Mexico temporarily. We thought, together with my family, we thought it was a temporary situation, but it has been now going on for 7 years. So this is why I'm living here. I've been living in Canada for the past 7 years.
I have to ask you, because I'm sure that it's crossed the minds of a lot of people about Mexico, is that with the rampant drug cartels and the drug violence that's going on. And I mean, there's and law enforcement so ineffective. How is this affecting the unions? I shouldn't say that. I should say, are the corporations behind a lot of the drug cartels that are in operation down there right now?
Because, you know, Mexico has been living, particularly in the last 12 years, during the two previous governments of the PAN party, the Conservative
right.
Party, Conservative Party. We have been living on the tremendous insecurity because of the war between the drug cartels. But lately, in the last few years, in the mining sector, many companies have been involved. In some cases, the drug cartels had bought some mines. They have acquired mines, and they are operating mines, particularly coal mines in the north of Mexico. This is publicly known. And they represent a threat to everybody because they have control. They usually make threats against the companies who buy this coal or any other minerals. And some of the companies have been probably been affected by this situation. In fact, yesterday, let me tell you, one of the CEOs of ArcelorMittal, one of the biggest producers of steel in the world, they have a large facility, steel facility, in the port of Lázaro Cárdenas in Michoacán, in the Pacific coast of Mexico. And one of the CEOs was found assassinated with a shot in his head. And yesterday, also, 7 miners in one of the mines operations in the north, in Chihuahua, were found dead. So, I mean, it's affecting more and more this situation of the insecurity and the war between the drug cartels and the mining industry. And so this is something that hasn't been under the control of the government and continues to happen every single day or week or month of the year.
Now, your negotiations with Vicente Fox during those years, how close was he with George Bush and with the American Republican Party? Because there was so much talk about the North American Union between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Sharing North American Union and the Trans Mexican Highway, and how much of that is a reality now and is part of the structure or part of the economic planning of Mexico and the United States and Canada?
Well, you know, Mexico has a great dependence, economic dependence, on the market of the United States. And the links between both governments have always been very close. But I think after Vicente Fox, in the year 2000, when Vicente Fox came to power and the PAN party, the Conservative Party, for the first time in the history of Mexico, Then I think the tides became closer. The opening up of the economy, the privatization processes of many companies, and of course the interest of many U.S. and Canadian companies in energy, in mining, develop and increase very, very much. To a point in which today in the mining sector, foreign investment in the mining sector, more than 70% belong to Canadian companies. And in the energy sector, a lot of American companies are really working very hard in order that the new government goes into the privatization of Pemex, the oil company. So tides have been always closed, but I think in the last 12 years have become much, much closer. And everybody was talking publicly about the dependence of Vicente Fox with Bush at that time, and also, with all this open up economy for foreign investments. So I think for Mexico and for the NAFTA agreement, probably it became very good for many companies, foreign companies, but not so much for Mexico, except for the big monopolies. So we lost a lot of jobs. We have a very high also unemployment rate in Mexico. And so these tides were affecting, of course, the situation of the working and the middle class in Mexico very seriously. Same as in the United States, probably in Canada. But in some cases, they were still very much affected. So at the point also in which today we speak, we used to talk that China, the works in China, used to earn $1 a day, and they have increased very much their wages now. And we are talking today that China, the workers in China are getting bigger salaries than in Mexico. So
really?
Mexico has been stagnant in this policy, and for the benefit of the big international corporations and multinational companies.
How bad actually are the working conditions in Mexico, and are they bad across all industries in Mexico besides mining? And does that account for the high level of immigrants coming to this country because of working conditions?
Well, I think the working conditions have deteriorated very much. And the lack of opportunities, this is why you have a big migration of the Mexican workers trying to find an opportunity in the U.S. market, in Canada. And so this is a really serious problem and threat this is why we have been, and let me tell you one thing, that we have been under the attack of the Mexican government, this conservative government, the Mine and Steelworkers Union, because we were demanding the highest, and we have got during the last 7 years, we have achieved the highest wage and benefit increases, 3 and 4 times above the rest of the workers or the average. We have got about 14% per year between wage and benefit increases in the Mine and Steelworkers Union. The rest of the country, at the average, is between 3 to 4%. What does it mean is that we were trying to increase the standard of living of the Mexican workers, to have better opportunities, more healthy, more safety and health, in order to prevent that they migrate or look for opportunities in the United States and Canada. But the Mexican government didn't like that. So this is why they attack our union. Even outside of our union, the rest of the industrial activities and services, are the working conditions are deteriorating very dramatically, so that the flow and the migration will increase and will continue. If you build the biggest wall, they will find a way or risk their lives in order to cross the border and look for an opportunity, because they are desperate to sustain their families and to keep alive them. And so this is a terrible situation.
I'd like to ask you, though, why is it that Mexico has never been able to accommodate enough work for its people?
We have a change in the administration every 6 years. And usually the government which comes into office or power for 6 years, they look for their activities only for the 4 or 5 most important years of that term. They usually we lack a vision of a statesman with a visionary of 10, 15, 20, or 20, or more than 20 years to create these opportunities, education for the children, and health conditions, and investment opportunities that are really create jobs, but are well, jobs which are well paid and treated with respect and dignity. And we haven't had governments with that view, I mean, with that vision. So this is something that is affecting and Mexico, and is really creating these bad conditions and the insecurity and the unemployment and all this resentment and coming closer and closer to a social crisis that we would, the majority of Mexicans would like to prevent and of course avoid as much as we can. But unfortunately, we haven't had these visionary governments and acting as statesmen, only maybe for the media, for this. But in real terms, the inequality of the income distribution has increased dramatically. I mean, 300 families control more than 50% of the national economy. That cannot be possible, and this is not a future for a country like Mexico with 115 million inhabitants.
The United States, 1% of the population owns, even less than 1%, one-tenth of 1% of the U.S. population owns over 50% of the United States' wealth. Okay, commands its own wealth. But what I wanted to ask you was there was a liberal political party back, I believe, in 2008, and I forget the guy's name, but they insisted that they won the election in Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the PRD, the left-wing party and candidate, López Obrador. They claimed that they won the elections. So in 2006 was the elections when Felipe Calderón was elected. And they always said, and I think the majority of the population in Mexico believed that it was a fraud. So in order to stay in power, this government of Calderón, who succeeded Vicente Fox, I mean, they have to give a lot of concessions to the big businesses and big companies of Mexico, and also to the foreign investment, and probably to our neighbors.
What happened to the guy, to that liberal candidate? He was very, very popular.
Yes, he is. Well, he competed again last year in the elections, and he also claimed that he won the elections. The pre-party won in July. Here they will recognize that the elections on the new party, the pre-party in power, is since the 1st of December with Enrique Peña Nieto. But López Obrador always claimed that the elections were won by him in 2006 and in 2012. And he continues running the country, saying that he is the president, the real elected president, and he campaigns all over the country, and he goes from one state to the other, and having political meetings and accusing of this government of stealing the election. So this is his position, and he has a lot of followers. That's for sure.
But you don't believe him, or you don't believe that the election was stolen?
Well, there are many doubts about that. It's very difficult to prove that. He choked. He brought a lot of, he brought a lot of evidence that saying that they bought the vote of the people, and the election was bought by them using like the debit cards and things, and they have proofs of thousands and thousands of these credit cards which allow you to buy, you know, food stuff or whatever, or medicines for 1,000 pesos or 500 pesos, whatever, which is $50 or $100 or less than that. And they use this in order to, and many companies to have this. But to prove that, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, the general idea, I mean, there are many doubts about the elections every 6 years. I mean, because I think the system doesn't allow to be completely transparent and democratic, as we should have one in Mexico.
That's the same way we're here, that we the same problem we have in the United States. Totally unverifiable, President Jimmy Carter, in the year 2000, when the Supreme Court wound up deciding the election of the United States president, Jimmy Carter was asked, would he be willing to oversee the U.S. elections? And he said that's impossible to oversee the U.S. elections because they're completely unverifiable, especially now with electronic voting.
Electronic voting with no record of who votes.
Yeah, and it can all be rigged. And he says the United States democratic system, the system is so rigged that it's impossible
to know if it's an honest vote or not, the way that the two parties in 1988, when we had elections, it was the first time that the left party with Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas was the candidate, and he always claimed on the party that they won the elections. And what happened is that when the system, they were counting the votes after the election, and he was competing against Carlos Salinas of the Pri Party. Then they count the votes in the most important, most populated states of Mexico City, and the neighbor states, which have the biggest population. And after four or five states in which all of them, the majority, vote for the left, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, then suddenly they stop the counting and they declare that the system failed, and they had to shut down the system, and later, a few days later, they reopened that, and then saying that Carlos Salinas, the pre-party, was on top of the elections. I mean, this is something that it was taken to the extreme of an election which was completely questioned about the validity and the transparency of this election. But this is part of the history of Mexico. If you allow me, I wanted to mention something. All this situation in which I've been in Canada and all this story, I wrote a book which is going to be launched next week, which is called Collapse of Dignity. And it tells the real story of this conflict and the truth about this conflict, how it began with this tragedy in the past conscious, but it goes much more than the tragedy itself. It goes to analyze and discuss, I mean, all the violations of the legal and judiciary system in Mexico, and all the, this is the fight against greed and corruption in the mining industry in Mexico. But it has a lot of, it's not just only a history of outrage, it's a history also of hope and ideas to have to create a new and a strong an independent labor movement, not only in Mexico, but all over the world. So this book, Collapse of Dignity, is going to be is published by Bembela Books in the United States. It will be launched next week on the 17th here in Vancouver during the National Policy Conference. And this is my real story, what I'm trying to share with everybody, and I hope that they will have the opportunity to read and learn about our resistance, our struggle, and how we really foresee that what is the future of the unions, and what we have to do in order to construct and build a strong and independent labor movement to have more justice and respect and dignity for the working and the middle class, only of Mexico but of the whole world.
If I can ask you, that's very noble, and that's what we hope for as well. But what I wanted to ask you was, How much work do you have to do? I mean, how organized this? I've never really heard. And I'm sorry that I haven't. I apologize for my ignorance on the global union. How does that? I mean, are you like the UN of unions, or how does this exactly organization that you're with, how does it function, and how does it, is it an overseer of all the internet, all the unions in the world, or what? You have 50 million members.
Yeah, we have 50 million members. Yeah, it's more than 120 unions and federations from more than 100 countries. It's the first and biggest global union. And it works through, there is an international executive committee. I'm the only one member from Mexico, and we have only three from Latin America. And Europe and Africa and North America and Asia, and all of them have their own members of the executive committee. We have meetings. We discuss global policies and strategies in terms of collective bargaining agreements, in terms of education, health, safety. And we try to come together. I mean, cases, for instance, where we have companies who act and operate in different countries, so we can work together and have a much more global strategy to protect and defend workers' rights and human rights in this. So
now
this is how it is. And yes.
Now, is that a global union? Are you active in internal politics in various countries to put your agenda forward?
Well, to protect and defend workers' rights, yes. When there are violations, of course, this organization will work and complain against the governments who are violating the law or the workers' rights. And we have many cases in which, you know, repression is very much used against workers in Philippines or in Africa or in Latin America or wherever. And then we use the power of the organization to put pressure. Yeah, it's a kind of United Nations for workers. I mean, not as big as United Nations because it's just only for the labor movement, but it's a kind of international organization to protect workers' rights. It's based on Geneva, Switzerland, and close to the ILO, the International Labor Organization. And we use also the pressure of the industry or global union to put pressure on the ILO in when there are cases of complaints for violations of workers of human rights. And so this is the way we act. We meet several times during the year in different places, and one of them at least is in Geneva, Switzerland, every year, and the rest can be depending on what the executive committee agrees where to celebrate the next meetings. But this is more or less in general terms, and there are general rules and support and assistance for unions who are or workers who are having problems and repressions or act of aggressions against themselves from this global union.
Well, I think it's really important that we have a strong global union. It's very difficult to fight multinational corporations.
Yes, and how do you...
Their injustices.
But...
Is
AFSCME a member of your? I mean, how does that work? How are you supported as a global union? I mean, is it through our regular union dues or through? How does it work? How do you?
There are some dues that every union has to pay for being a member of this global organization. But, you know, the principle and the idea, I mean, a group of union leaders that we met frequently, we some years ago, let's say about 8 years ago, 10 years ago, among others, the United Steelworkers, I remember when we signed Leo Girard, the international president of the United Steelworkers, and myself, and a strategic alliance between the United Steelworkers and the mine and steelworkers of Union of Mexico. We decided at that time that if we didn't join efforts and we didn't globalize the labor movement, as same as the multinational companies were globalizing their strategies, in 10, 15 years we were going to disappear because the global companies are growing so much in power with the governments and in terms of profits and economic power and political power that we had to do the same. And then we realized and we came to this idea of having a global union movement, a labor movement that could also compensate and defend themselves of all these abuses that are usually are committed in the world today. So we are working in that direction, and I hope that we are going to bring more strength and power to the labor movement in the future through these actions that we are taking through this industrial global union that we are members of.
Well, we certainly hope so. We've come to the end of our show.
Before we end the program, I just wanted to say that I'd like to invite you back on again in the near future, but to discuss this. But I just wanted to let you know that you always have a voice here on our program for the global and Mexican unions, mining unions, anything that we can do to help you out and get the word out. That's what we're here for. So we want to thank you.
And we want people to remember your book, The Collapse of Dignity. Very interesting read. And thanks very much. And I'm so sorry you had to leave your country and settle somewhere else.
Hopefully,
but I'm glad you can.
Yeah, I know. I've been reelected 6 times unanimously during the last 6 years by the different conventions. I think I'm the only case, I don't know if in the world or in Mexico, but the workers keep loyalty to me, and because we have got the best union and the best strategies to negotiate and protect and defend workers' rights. So this is my commitment, and in this book, Collapse of Dignity, this story is written, and I hope that everybody can have a look at the book and read the book, because there are many things, more just than a tragedy, the history of a tragedy, but it's much more than that. It's a really a visionary message of hope, of building and constructing justice, respect, and dignity for the working class and the middle classes all over the world.
Thank you very much, and we hope to have you on again soon. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. I will. Thank you very much. On the contrary. Thank you. Good night.
That was Napoleon Gomez talking to us about his book, The Collapse of Dignity, which is on sale now, and telling us about his work.
No, it's going to be on sale next week.
And telling us about his work in a global union and some of the problems they've had in Mexico. And experience really worldwide.
Right.
But Mexico, that mine tragedy was terrible.
But again, collapseofdignity.com, you can go to that and you can read a little bit about his book. And actually, you can order it right there. Collapse of Dignity.
And thanks for being with us. And we hope you join us again
tomorrow.
Next week. And you can join Leo tomorrow, where he ventures into the realm of where are you going tomorrow, Leo?
Not sure, but join me.
Some esoteric knowledge, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, good night, folks. Have a pleasant evening.
Good night, everyone.